The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Oh, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. He was traveling back from the US. He got back in Edstone this morning. I saw him briefly, so he arrived safely. But a transatlantic flight and then a live show all in one morning would be quite the tall order. So I have the opportunity to guest host for the day. And today we're going to be talking about perhaps some of the most up-to-the-minute coverage that we've ever done. At least it's up there on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're going to talk about something that happened 10 minutes ago, and we'll bring you some footage, hopefully, if all works out, of that. But first, we'll start with a story that's not quite that up to the minute, but one that's still from this weekend. And we'll talk about an important story coming out of Britain and out of Britain's royal family. So just over the weekend, we had excerpts from a new biography of Prince Harry published in the Times newspaper. So over 3 days, they had different chapters of it. The full biography comes out, I think, in just over another week, maybe 2 weeks. But we've got some excerpts of it, and it's pretty explosive. It's, the book is called Finding Freedom, and it's basically Prince Harry's side of the story when it comes to this split in the royal family. But this is something that's worth looking at. It's worth paying attention to. You know, we don't just pay attention to this because I'm British and Mr. Flurry is living in England. There is an important global reason for paying attention to what is happening in the royal family. We had a cover article on the royal family in 2017, and on that, Mr. Flurry, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry, he wrote, "What is wrong with Britain and the royal family? This issue is far more important than people generally realize." So we're going to have a bit of a look at that issue just for the first segment today before we get into, our up-to-the-minute reporting. So this book, Finding Freedom, the authors kind of claim that it is independent, that it's just their research and has no input from Prince Harry or from Meghan. But then it's all full of these tiny, tiny details. What the chairs felt like in the location where they had their first date. What they ate or what they drank and what they didn't eat on that first date, conversations, private conversations between Prince Harry and his brother, details of a FaceTime conversation that Meghan Markle had from the bath, thoughts, what Prince Harry and Meghan thought after certain encounters. You know, it's hard to see a lot of this detail coming from anyone other than the couple themselves. And then anybody's published any kind of details or intimate details of their lives, Harry and Meghan have complained, they've even sued. But this time, nothing. No criticism at all for Finding Freedom. It's clearly kind of Prince Harry's side of the story of the split from the royal family. And the media and the whole world is pretty much taking it as that. This is Prince Harry's side of the story. And it's also cementing that divide. It's quite the attack on the Britain's royal family, on especially his brother Prince William and Kate. They don't come out well. I think Prince Harry comes out looking worse, really, in the biography. But it's not designed to paint them in a flattering light at all. The Times it was royal correspondent Roya Nicker. She wrote, "The book is likely to make particularly hurtful reading for the Queen." And she said that the royal family come under heavy artillery fire in Finding Freedom, page after page. Heavy artillery fire. Civil war in the royal family, you could say. She wrote that once this book is published next month, neither the prospect of a reconciliation nor the resumption of their royal life seems likely soon. And I saw just this morning another article from the Daily Mail talking about how this was just really burning the bridges now. There was no way back after this, they said, for this article was saying, for Prince Harry, this book is the point of no return, where he very publicly attacks his own family. And you know, this book, well, it comes, we talked about this briefly on the show a few weeks ago. It comes after Prince Harry very publicly sided with Black Lives Matter and that whole movement. Actually, we've got a clip. This is a clip of him praising Black Lives Matter in a conference call with you know, Black Lives Matter activists and transgender activists and all of the, you know, some really radical people. And this is what he said to them. This is clip one.
And for the first time ever, thanks to the Black Lives Matter movement, that doesn't have a single address, doesn't have a single leader, it is a movement that is swept across the world, that finally everybody who knows and recognizes the wrong in this for years and years, decades, hundreds of years gone by, that this is the moment when people are starting to be listened to.
So thanks to Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter is a wonderful movement, he's saying. Meanwhile, these Black Lives Matter activists are tearing down statues. They're writing or spray painting racist on Winston Churchill's statue. They're attacking Britain's history. They're saying Britain is a racist country, institutionally racist, accusations with no evidence behind them at all. And then he's supporting this and even agreeing. Here's just another clip where he basically is implying that that the British Commonwealth is racist. This is clip two.
Certainly when you look across the Commonwealth, there's no way that we can move forward unless we acknowledge the past. And I think so many people have done such an amazing, incredible job of acknowledging the past and trying to right those wrongs. But I think we all acknowledge on here that there is so much more still to do. It's not going to be easy, and in some cases it's not going to be comfortable, but it needs to be done because guess what? Everybody benefits.
So that's him saying, well, look, we need to change the British Commonwealth. We need to look at the deep-rooted racism there. The British Commonwealth, you know, that's not even the British Empire. The Commonwealth was something, you know, that's been going on for a much shorter amount of time and is a voluntary association. Anybody can join, anybody can leave. There are members of the British Commonwealth or the Commonwealth that were never even part of the British Empire. Yet he's up there claiming that it's racist, you know, joining in the attack on British history. And then in this book, he's really attacking the royal family. And it talks about, well, it goes through, just to go through some of the content, it talks about how the divide between him and his brother, Prince William, well, that began when he and Meghan really began to get serious. And it says that Prince William was worried that Harry was moving too quickly. And so he said, don't feel like you need to rush this. Take as much time as you need to get to know this girl. Again, this is all according to that biography. But Harry took offense at this phrase, this girl. He decided that was snobbish. The biography tells us that Harry had learned not to make snap judgments about people based on their accent, education, ethnicity, class, or profession. And the implication and the way it brings that up after that comment is that, well, Prince William hadn't. He hadn't learned this lesson and he was making a snap judgment. It talks about how friends say that he believes a lot of people are out to get him. A lot of people are against him and Meghan, he says. It also has it attacks the Duchess of Cambridge, Kate or Catherine Middleton, she was. It's failing to reach out to Meghan and it kind of puts her in a bad... It doesn't really give anything specific that she did that was bad. But tries to paint her in a negative light of not being welcoming enough or reaching out enough to Meghan. That Times commentator, Nika, she wrote, Harry's feeling of indignation towards his brother in the book are palpable. And he's angry with the rest of the royal family. And then this sense of victimization just continues throughout those chapters that were there. The biography, it says, Harry and Meghan were already propelling the monarchy to new heights around the world. And it said that other members of the royal family and courtiers, they were getting jealous because they believed that the global interest in and popularity of the Sussexes needed to be reined in. The biography says the establishment feared that their popularity might eclipse that of the royal family. So the royal family was worried that Harry and Meghan were taking too much of the spotlight. And so they were deliberately trying to block them and victimize them. And cut them down. That's the message that it puts across. The book quotes an anonymous source saying that Harry feels that there were so many occasions when the institution and his family could have helped them, stood up for them, backed them up, and never did. And, you know, just goes through more of these different grievances. It says that Harry had lost respect for parts of the institution and even for certain family members at points. And then it talked about how they felt mistreated in their final royal engagement. The Commonwealth Service at Westminster, or one of their latest engagements at Westminster. And after that, it said that Meghan left for Canada and said, well, it quotes a friend of Meghan, at this point, she couldn't imagine wanting to set a foot back into anything royal again. Just a total break. And then the biography goes on to basically say that this victimization was largely a result of sexism and racism. And so really they're talking now, they're basically making accusations of racism right in the heart of Britain's royal family. And all across Britain, the book says Meghan felt as though some of the commentary and tabloid stories were more than a culture clash. They were sexist and prejudice. It says racism takes a different form in the UK from America, but there was no mistaking its existence and how ingrained it is. And it gives an example, headlines like, "Memo to Meghan, we Brits prefer true royalty to fashion royalty." So according to that book, that's one of those unmistakable proofs of ingrained racism. I genuinely have no idea how they get racism from that headline, but that's the accusation that, and we've seen that right since this whole Harry and Meghan kind of saga blew up, when they wanted to leave at the start of the year, these accusations of racism. Back then, I think those accusations of racism mostly came from supporters of Harry and Meghan. Now it seems like it's coming from them themselves through this biography, that they're attacked because they're a racist. And the biography makes clear that, it says that Harry basically looked at everything through the lens of race. It says, when he first started seeing Meghan, Harry, sensitive to even the slightest hint of prejudice, had fallouts within his own circle. When someone questioned his new relationship and whether she was suitable, he would wonder, is this about race? Is it snobbery? An old friend of Harry spent an afternoon gossiping about Meghan, making disparaging remarks about her Hollywood background. Word got back to Harry, and the prince immediately cut him off. So any criticism of her, into his mind, was apparently immediate proof of racism. Joanne Williams, describing the biography at The Spectator, wrote that every encounter is deemed to be an expression of deep-rooted racism. Relationships cannot survive such scrutiny. Loyalty to family, monarchy, and country is jettisoned in the desire to expose every awkward glance and clumsy phrase. She writes that Finding Freedom suggests that Harry and Meghan are a thin-skinned couple prepared to sell out close family members in the name of settling petty gripes and grievances. So just like we read at the start, the royal family training its artillery on each other. And like I said, we look at this story not just to get into kind of gossipy headlines and not just because I'm British. There's an important reason for looking at this and for watching this for the whole world. There's a global interest here and importance. Now, Mr. Armstrong talked about this in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. If you haven't read that, I would really encourage you to go to our website, thetrumpet.com, and order that. All of the literature that we talk about on this program is free. We're always very happy to send that to you. And we ship it just about anywhere in the world. If you don't want, you can also read it online and download the PDF. But for a lot of these books, we would really encourage you to get the print copy. And we would rather send you that free print copy rather than just have you read it online, even though the online reading is cheaper for us, because you're going to get so much more out of it, studying it, digging deeply into the spiritual riches. But in that book, in The United States and Britain and Prophecy, Mr. Armstrong talked about how the royal family, how this family in Britain, it's descended from King David of ancient Israel. And if you believe that the Bible is the literal word of God, that's something you have to take seriously. You know, maybe you haven't heard that before. But you can look in 1 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 13, for example. God tells David, he gives David this promise. He says there'll always be a descendant sitting on a throne. And that promise is repeated throughout. There's so many different scriptures in the Old Testament where God tells David, there's going to be, you'll have a descendant on this throne always. And now we know that Jesus Christ will eventually rule on David's throne. You can see that in Luke chapter 1 and verse 30 and I think up to about verse 33. But Christ isn't ruling on earth right now. The kingdom of God isn't here. There's no literal physical kingdom that Jesus Christ is sitting on the throne of. So, well, you know, Christ was here 2,000 years ago. Over the last 2,000 years, well, where could there have been a continuous throne of people to have fulfilled that promise? Or are we just going to... And otherwise, what did these promises fail? Were they wrong? Is the Bible unreliable? So we've got to look at this. You know, God made some very clear and specific promises, and Mr. Armstrong in that book goes through and shows how that throne was moved to Britain and gives proof of that throne being from Britain, going in there in much more detail than I'm going to get to today. But God made sure that happened, and God often associates that throne with a light or a lamp. We can turn to a scripture, actually. I've referenced a few, but 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 36. I should have written that one out in my notes, but I guess I wasn't initially planning to turn there, but I feel bad about keep throwing them out and not actually reading any. 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 36. This says, this is a prophet of God speaking, "Unto his sons will I give one tribe, that David my servant may have a light always before me in Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen me to put my name there." So there would be a light. Mr. Flurry writes in the former prophet's booklet, I think it is, "God made a promise that there would never lack a man to sit on David's throne. That covenant itself is a lamp to the world." Just the fact that God made this promise thousands of years ago and has kept it over all of the upheavals of history. How many monarchies have even survived all the way now, until now? You go back just even 100 years and Europe was full of monarchies that are not around anymore. But over thousands of years, God made sure that there was a man sitting on that throne, and that in itself, that's a lamp to this world, a light, a beacon of hope for the whole world, a powerful sign that God is ultimately in control of world events. But those that sit on the throne, they have an opportunity to set an example for their nation and for the world, to be a light themselves. We can turn back just to 2 Samuel chapter 21. And this is some of David's supporters talking to him in verse 17. It says, "Then the men of David swore unto him, saying, You shall go no more out with us into battle, that you quench not the light of Israel." So Mr. Flurry wrote, "David set a wonderful example of trusting in God, and he inspired others to do the same." So that's what God wants of people on that throne, to be a light to Israel. But then what kind of example has the modern royal family been setting? There's a public example there for the world to learn from at the moment, and even in what's happening with Prince Harry, but it's not an example of one to imitate. You know, Prince Charles had one of the most publicly dysfunctional marriages in modern times. And Mr. Flurry, this was in the New Throne of David booklet, he said that that Prince Charles there and that marriage set a clear example of infidelity, immorality, and treachery. Can we really pretend that their example didn't have an effect on British society? And you don't have to go back too far, too many decades, to a time where marriage was the norm. And now I don't have the statistics on hand, but I don't think it is anymore for bringing up children. Now it's more like just a few decades ago, unmarried cohabitation. Well, that used to be very rare, and now it's very common. And how much did Prince Charles and his publicly dysfunctional marriage have of downgrading the role of that institution of marriage in the eyes of many people? You know, setting an example of infidelity and then divorce and then marriage. I think, well, I don't want to go into all of the details, but it wasn't a good example. Mr. Flory wrote, "Family is the most important relationship that exists. If you studied in the Bible, you see that it is a God-plane relationship. And then now, more and more, we're seeing the fruits of that failed marriage. The fruits of that going wrong, being put out on before the whole world. You've got both William and Harry embracing very anti-family causes. They're promoting things like homosexuality and other LGBT issues. And then now you've got that family divided and attacking each other in public. Now, this is the natural result of Prince Charles's family problems. There's an example there. But like I said, a negative example. And then, as I mentioned, Prince Harry's support for the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, how is this family going to serve as a light for Britain and a light for the world? Well, it can't. And so Mr. Flory has been writing for several years about an important change God has made regarding that royal family. As he gets prepared now, very soon, to have a royal family, to have Jesus Christ on that throne, shining the brightest light ever to the whole world. It was, like I said, the September 2017 Trumpet magazine. I already quoted very briefly from that. That was called The Fall of the British Royal Family. And Mr. Flory said in that article that the royal family is in rapid decline. He wrote, "God is already changing the way he deals with the royal family, which explains why 2017 has been tragic so far." Has been so tragic so far. So, you know, he was writing that in 2017 and saying, God has made a change in the way that he works with the royal family. There's going to be rapid decline. And what have we seen since then? World events and events in the royal family have powerfully brought that out. Just even the events from this weekend, that should make us sit up and take note of somebody that forecast that in 2017 and say, well, maybe we should look into that. Is God behind a statement like that? Because no human can predict the future so accurately. Is there divine revelation behind that forecast that the royal family is going into rapid decline? And it's not just even been Prince Harry. There's the whole Prince Andrew and Jeffrey Epstein, and he's had to retire from royal life. And I could spend quite a long time going. I think some of the things that were kind of big disasters for the royal family that we used to talk about, we don't even talk about anymore because they've been eclipsed by some of these so much bigger disasters. And there is bad news here for the royal family that things are going to get much, much worse. You know, God wants a throne that does give light. And it's not going to happen from the royal family that's in Britain. So God has to make some important changes. And so there are, there's much more rapid decline coming for that family in Britain, here in Britain. But the good news is that this is all part of God's plan to bring light to the whole world. He's changing the way that he deals with the royal families. He prepares to intervene in world events and bring in far more light. So that's what a good ruler does, brings in light. 2 Samuel 23, this is the last words of David. I'll just read verse 3 and 4 from the Revised Standard Version. And it says, "When one rules justly over men, ruling in the fear of God, he dawns on them like the morning light, like the sun shining forth upon a cloudless morning, like rain that makes grass to sprout from the earth." And Mr. Flory, in the former prophet's book, he wrote, "God's loving government is like the morning when the sun rises in a cloudless sky. It's like the tender grass springing beneath a brilliant sun after a pleasant rain." Read these versions in the Revised Standard Version, these verses, which we just did, and there's a lot more in that kind of poetry that David gave there. And Mr. Flory writes, "There's no greater poetry in the Bible about God's loving government." So Jesus Christ is preparing to come to this world to bring light to the world, but God is preparing other people to sit on that throne, other people to bring light to the world. Now, that's what we're learning to do now. That's why God has a church. It's not just to get people saved. It's to train for a very practical job, to do what Prince Harry and the royal family failed to do and bring light to the world. And how do we do that? How do we train to bring light to the world? Well, we get behind God's work and we bring light to the world today. It's not just about individual salvation. We have a work to do today, bringing light to the world, and this trains us to be lights for God in the future. That's why God has a church. In Isaiah 60, I'll just read a couple more passages before the break. God states, "Arise, shine, for your light is come, and the glory of the Lord is risen upon you." And then in verse 3 it says, "And the Gentiles shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your rising." And again, I think this is also from the former prophets booklet. I didn't write down exactly where. Mr. Flurry writes, "The Gentiles and the whole world are all going to come to us and come to that light when we are glorified like God. They will be eager to go where God is glorified. We need to manifest as much of that glory as we can today and bring people to that wonderful, precious light." A bit further down, he says, "God's goal is to glorify you as he is glorified." Isaiah 60, verse 1 to 3 says, "God is going to glorify us the way he is glorified if we glorify him on earth today." That is special. God wants his glory here today. That's why you are here. So, yes, there's no light coming from that royal family. And we looked at some of even the darkness and division that we're seeing from that throne. But God is preparing a light for the world. And I'll just conclude with a quote from Mr. Flurry. He says, "That lamp of David's throne burns forever. It is about to fill this world with its light." So if you want to learn more about how God is getting ready right now, in a very real and practical way to fill this world with light, I'd really encourage you to read his new book, I guess it's 2 or 3 years old now, but a newish book, The New Throne of David. If you've not read that already, even if you have, we're very happy for you to read that, for us to send you a copy. If you just go to our website, thetrumpet.com, if you click on the literature tab at the top right-hand corner, and you can find that book. If you have trouble ordering it online, you can drop us an email at td@kpcg.fm, and we'd be very happy to send you that book as we try to get this light and hope out to the largest audience possible. Well, we'll take a quick break, and then we'll get back and talk about our up-to-the-minute breaking news. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. An exciting, pulsating, vital third of all the Bible is devoted to prophecy. And approximately 90% of all prophecy pertains to our time, now, in this 21st century. It is a warning to us, to our English-speaking peoples, of immediate life and death import. The prophecies come alive once their doors are opened by this now-discovered master key. The United States and Britain in prophecy will open, to open minds, this hitherto closed vital third of all the Bible. No story of fiction ever was so strange, so fascinating, so absorbing, so packed with interest and suspense as this gripping story of our identity and our ancestry. Request The United States and Britain in Prophecy and a free 1-year subscription to The Trumpet magazine right now. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to The Trumpet Daily radio show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. I don't need that up there. Well, I guess I promised you some up-to-the-minute news. Well, it's just about 40 minutes ago now. NASA successfully launched, at least I hope it's successfully, it hasn't blown up in the few minutes that I've been on the show, successfully launched its latest and most advanced mission to Mars. I think you can see the countdown. This is on the screen there. Again, this was just from about 40 minutes ago, getting ready to take off. It always is impressive to see these launch videos. But it's a busy time of year for Mars at the moment. This is the third of a series of missions launched by countries around the world just in the last week or two. Heading up to Mars, there we go. The countdown's off if you're watching the YouTube stream, and you can see this rocket shooting up with just a massive amount of bright flame or fire or whatever it is that shoots out the back there, and up it goes. When I was watching this video earlier, I was just fascinated by seeing they had a little ticker on the screen showing how many miles above the surface this rocket was, and it was just going up almost, you can see it on the screen now if you're watching, and it's almost every second or so pretty soon it starts going up another mile, and you think about how fast it's traveling, and then you watch and kind of marvel at that for a bit, and the higher it goes the faster it ends up getting, and soon it's 3-4 miles every second as it shoots up there. Just an incredible feat of engineering, and you can see why Mr. Armstrong wrote about how God gave man a God-type mind. Just really an incredible achievement. But just about a week ago, China also had their Mars mission. Actually, I think we've got some B-roll we can show you of that. See, just got too many videos of rockets launching for Mars at the moment. So NASA's mission, they're sending a rover up there that's going to land on the surface. The Chinese mission is kind of unique in that they're trying to do several things at once. They're sending an orbiter and a lander and a rover onto the planet there. It's a pretty big step forwards for them, and a giant leap forwards for their space program. Like I said, they're trying to do really what NASA did over years, maybe even decades. And then the United Arab Emirates is another group launching a rocket. We've got, here we go, just a bit of footage of their rocket being launched from Japan. I think it was a Mitsubishi-built built rocket that was carrying it up there. But there you go. The United Arab Emirates also with their mission to Mars. So what's going on at the moment? Are we in a new space race? Why is everybody racing to get to Mars? What does that have to do with us? Well, I'll just play. This is one more clip. This is, talks about some of the specifics of that, of the NASA mission, what they'll be up to. But also, you hear from the vice president talking about this this new space race. This is clip 4.
Every 2 years, there's a critical window to go to Mars. This summer, the planets align so that a spacecraft can get there with the least amount of fuel. NASA is sending its 9th spacecraft to the red planet's surface, and other nations are trying to go too. One is China, which is launching its first solo expedition, aiming to send in one go as much equipment as the US did in several missions to potentially find evidence of past or present life.
That's a whole lot of steps at once. China will really have made a stand for their space agency and for their country.
We're in a space race today, just as we were in the 1960s. And the stakes are even higher.
The US and China are contenders for science, profit, and pride beyond the stratosphere. And China has made a lot of progress. Since 2018, it has sent more rockets than any other country and has become the second biggest spender in space programs behind the US.
Are we in a new space race? And he was saying, well, it's even more important than ever. Yeah, you had the vice president there saying. And there's a good reason that he said that. If you think about the first space race, space was all new and nobody was really using space much. You know, there weren't tons of satellites orbiting the Earth. Whereas now we rely on space a whole lot more than you might think. Europe, a few years ago, they estimated that 10% of its economy was dependent on satellite navigation, and they projected that to grow to 30% by 2030. And that's just one aspect of controlling space, and that's used in a huge variety of ways, ways that you wouldn't even think about. There's aeroplane navigation and boats. There are boats that steer themselves due to GPS. It's used in heavy mining. Precision agriculture is even a thing, where you have autonomous agricultural tools reliant on GPS, the GPS system to navigate around fields, and you know, farms using it to spray their crops accurately and efficient efficiently, in construction, in road building, archaeology. They'll use GPS in map making, satellite communication, both, you know, GPS, or you rely satellite for the communication itself, but you also, for a lot of that, you need to know precisely where you are in order to point to the satellite. And even they're getting involved in using GPS in sports training and things like this. You know, there's a whole variety, a huge variety of ways that it's used, but so much of it is used in the military. I mean, if you think about the world that we live in now, you know, right now, there are probably unmanned killer robots hovering in the skies above the Middle East, ready to rain down death upon America's enemies, guided by pilots sitting hundreds of miles away, bouncing their instructions off satellites. We have smart bombs guided to within inches of their targets. You see videos of when America, when there's a major American military operation, the president can watch in the White House. Thanks to satellite communication, American commanders view the battlefield, watch their soldiers move across it, using those surveillance and positioning satellites. And they rely on that information to coordinate attacks, to avoid friendly fire. American missile warning satellites, you know, they're watching above the atmosphere for potential missile attacks. So much of America's military dominance relies on its power above the skies, its domination of space. You know, nobody else really has anything quite like this. You know, even France, you know, not exactly a backwards country, after fighting side by side with America in Afghanistan and kind of went back to fighting by themselves, they had to unlearn all of this reliance on the space-based systems because they didn't want to rely on the United States, which that's a story for another day. But the Scientific American, a few years ago, they had kind of an investigation into this. They wrote that the world's most worrisome military flashpoint is arguably not in the Taiwan Strait, the Korean Peninsula, Iran, Israel, Kashmir, or Ukraine. In fact, it cannot be located on any globe. The contested territory, the no man's land of Earth's orbit, where a conflict is unfolding that is an arms race in all but name. And so you see these headline-grabbing missions to Mars, and yes, there's a competition for prestige and status, just like there was in the space race, but there's also a competition for dominance and for who can shoot down each other's satellites. And a lot of these other countries, they don't have the same satellite technology. So there's no, America can't threaten, well, you destroy ours, we'll destroy yours. Instead, it's just a case of taking down what America has. And the thing with, it's like everything. You know, it's much easier to knock something down than it is to build it. A lot of these countries are developing their own space-based capabilities very successfully, very quickly. But at the same time, they don't have to equal the United States to be able to knock down what the United States has and get rid of that special advantage. And we're seeing more news about this kind of a space race going on as well. So just in the last week or so, for example, Russia tested a new anti-satellite weapon that it has a type of sub-satellite, Cosmos 25431, that releases a small projectile. So to put that in English, Russia is looking at satellites that can shoot down other satellites. Now, that's against international law. There are treaties against doing that. They're doing it anyway. And I think this was from the Chatham Institute. They wrote, by releasing a small projectile from the Cosmos 2543 sub-satellite, the U.S. claims that Russia has launched a new projectile into orbit with relatively high speed, estimated at around 500 kilometers an hour, leading to concerns about the potential for Russia to develop this technology as a weapon to target foreign satellites. And in China, China's President Xi Jinping has talked about China becoming a global space giant. And China's been practicing shooting down satellites. You know, it back all the way in 2007, they got this whole discussion about space-based warfare started, really, by shooting down one of its own satellites that was 530 miles above Earth's surface. Well, now they can reach thousands of miles. They proved in 2013 that they could shoot down satellites 19,000 miles above Earth's surface. They're moving very fast. Just 6 years from 530 miles above Earth's surface to 19,000. And then there's lots of other things that could be done to sabotage a satellite in a way that's maybe less aggressive than blowing it up, to degrade it without even the person knowing it was you that did it, or that even that it was deliberately damaged. But there are prophecies in the Bible that make this worth watching. Mr. Flurry had a landmark article back in June 1999 called America's Achilles Heel. Or that one might have been called America's Achilles Heel in Germany. There are a couple of different versions of it. But he was quoting in that article from the Intelligence Digest, and that wrote, "The Gulf War showed what a critical role technology now plays in warfare. But the course of a battle would be very different if effective technology sabotaging measures could be instituted against the superior force." And then that went on to say, "Computer dependence is the Western world's Achilles heel. And within a few years, this weakness could be tested to the full." And so Mr. Flurry talked about cyber warfare in that article, the danger of a cyber attack. And he talked about how you've got these prophecies in the book of Ezekiel that talks about, well, the trumpet is sounded and nobody goes forth to battle. There's the alarm, something's coming, something's happening, and nobody moves, nobody does anything. Well, what could cause that? And he talked about how, well, cyber warfare could play a role, would play a very important role in that. But you can see some of this space warfare playing a very similar role. A lot of the points that Mr. Flurry made in that article could apply to America's reliance on all this satellite and space technology that we're seeing in this new space race. And this is something that a lot of experts are talking about as well. There was a book a few years ago. It was kind of jokingly called The Book Everybody at the Pentagon is Reading. It was a novel called Ghost Fleet by a couple of military experts, P.W. Singer and August Cole. They typically write kind of papers and academic things, and they decided to write this novel just showing how they thought World War III could be fought and what kind of weapons might be involved and this kind of thing. And it begins with a simultaneous cyber attack and the destruction of America's satellites. And it's crippling to America. And the technology that they used in that isn't really fictional. If you think, well, Mr. Flurry, I'll just quote another couple of things from that article. He said, "One of the main reasons the Allies won World War II was that the British broke the German radio code. They knew most of Germany's war plans in advance. Quite a gigantic advantage. Germany's computer hackers might be inspired by Britain's radio code breaking in World War II. Today, they could be working to breach America's military code computers. They could know war plans and even stop them by wrecking the US's computer-run military. This is not a matter to take lightly, and shutting down space would have a similar effect. It would blind the US. And we talk about America being the world's biggest military spender by far and spending hundreds of billions each year, but it's because it buys smart bombs and drones, all of which would just suddenly become useless if there's some kind of space-based attack." So that prophecy that I mentioned is in Ezekiel 7 and verse 14. It says, "They have blown the trumpet even to make all ready, but none goes to the battle, for my wrath is on the multitude thereof." And Mr. Flurry writes, "It seems everybody is expecting our people to go into battle, but the greatest tragedy imaginable occurs. Nobody goes to battle, even though the trumpet is blown. Will it be because of computer terrorism?" And could tied right in with that, some of this space warfare play a role in that? And in that article, like I mentioned, Mr. Flurry focused a lot on Europe and Germany, and that's where you get an insight from Bible prophecy. A lot of what you see in the world, people focus on Russia and China. And Europe doesn't draw attention to themselves the same way Russia and China do. They don't carry out these kind of very public tests. China and Russia are trying to send a clear message. Don't underestimate us. We're powerful nations. Europe, on the other hand, I think wants to be underestimated and doesn't want anyone to think of them as a threat. So they're not publicizing their capabilities in the same way. But they're every bit as capable as Russia and China, if not more so. In some ways, it's kind of amusing as well just to see the shenanigans, I guess, that Europe goes through with some of their space missions. For example, they were launching a satellite program. And initially, it was all about environmental security. I can't remember the full acronym, but it was about Earth monitoring for environmental security. So, okay, well, it's about the weather and watching for forest fires and earthquakes. It's a monitoring system for environmental security. And then a little bit later, once it had got all the funding approved and things like that, they just tweaked the wording slightly. And it was no longer about monitoring environmental security. It was about monitoring for the environment and security. So slightly different. So afterwards, it's basically admission of, oh, it's a spy satellite. We're not just monitoring environmental security, we're monitoring the environment and security. So you've got Europe joining in. Like I said, you don't expect to see them shooting down a satellite to show off that they can do it. But with that focus you get from the Bible from Bible prophecy, you can see that Europe is the place to watch for this. And if you want to read more, that article is America's Achilles Heel and Germany. Well, there's one more subject I want to talk about from this Mars mission. Instead of a break, I'll play you just one more clip about this mission. This tells you a bit more about what NASA is doing and what NASA's mission is about. This church and Mr. Flurry and Mr. Armstrong have a long history of an involvement and of watching these Mars missions. So there's one final aspect of this I want to talk about before we go today. So this is clip three.
It'll take more than 6 months to get there, but NASA's next generation of Mars rovers, this one named Perseverance, is like a rover on steroids. Self-driving and mapping, equipped with microphones so humans can listen to the Martian surface, 19 cameras, then radar, spectrometers, sensors, and probes, and drills to collect soil and rock samples that a future mission will pick up. But the coolest feature of all, a miniature helicopter named Ingenuity attached to the belly of the rover. The first aircraft ever to take off and land on another planet for aerial surveys.
So I have to see if all of that works. Like I said, there's so much. I mean, this is similar to a mission that NASA did a few years ago, which just kind of blew my mind what they were capable of. This is basically a hovering sky crane dropping a self-driving car or lowering a self-driving car gently onto the surface of another planet. And then you've got the fact that it takes 40 minutes to get any radio signals from there back to Earth. So the poor mission controllers are sitting there waiting to find out whether their mission is a success or not, knowing that, well, actually the project that they devoted the last years of their life to could be a smoldering wreck on Mars's surface. But in some ways, it's also disappointing. There's all of this ingenuity and just the best of the human mind on a physical level and very impressive thinking and planning poured into something. And this mission, it's all about, is there life on Mars? One news outlet called it the most intensive search for life on Mars since the 1970s. It's about man looking for answers in the dust of Mars. That's where they'll get their answers, and it wants to drill down into this dust. The scientists say that there was once a lake where this rover has landed, and so they think that if they drill down, they might be able to find some microbes. And they're looking for that to find out answers. Like, where did we come from? How were we created? How did we get here? How did we evolve? And if we look back on Mars, then maybe we can answer those questions. What are we here for? So a hugely impressive mission, but looking in a massive effort to look for answers in the wrong place. Mr. Flurry talked about this last time I was on the show. I talked about this article he wrote years ago about Mars. I didn't write down the article, the title this time. I think it was something about Mars and you, or Mars and your incredible human potential. But he wrote, "Why do our scientists want to reach Mars? It keeps getting back to one overall question. Is there life on Mars? But they're asking the wrong question. They should ask, why is Mars and the universe there? Then we would all begin to get our minds on the creator, first of all. Scientists today get their minds focused on the creation, not the creator. And that is an exercise in futility and rebellion against God, though it may be done in ignorance." He said in that article, "Mars should inspire us beyond words to describe, but it never will until we understand our destiny as God does." And Mars was something that really inspired Mr. Armstrong. I kind of find this history fascinating. But all the way back in 1976, July 20th, The very first photographs ever taken on Mars, they were transmitted, to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and the California Institute of Technology, but just down the road from that was Ambassador Auditorium. And the JPL, they arranged to transmit those first photographs ever taken from the surface of Mars to that auditorium so that a public audience might be able to come in and see that those pictures. And I think around 1,000 people came to watch. Mr. Armstrong, he wrote a co-worker letter. He talked about how he got up at 3:30 in the morning and that he arrived at that auditorium before 5 a.m. He came in to see those pictures. You know, he was eager to fill those pictures, see those pictures. And he talks about those spectacular pictures arriving. In there, he said, Dr. Thomas Munch, a geology professor and leader of the team of scientists in the mission control room, gave a cry of delight as the first strips of the pictures came through. And he talked about how excited they were. But Mr. Armstrong wrote, I had to think. It showed precisely what I had expected from what is revealed from the God of creation in the Bible. It was a dry, barren surface of decay and futility, totally unproductive. And Mr. Armstrong knew exactly what to expect from the first ever photos from another planet, because the Bible tells us that's where the answers are. But he says, you can realize the thrill I experienced seeing in our own House of God auditorium the first real close-up photographs from the very surface of Mars, confirming the state the Bible reveals such planets are in today. He wrote about this experience in his book, The Incredible Human Potential, as well. He talks about how it was of very special interest to him. And he talks about people coming up there. And he brought up this passage in Romans chapter 8 and said, this is what those pictures quite clearly showed. He said, I had to realize that this scientific laboratory right here in Pasadena, great minds are in fact uncovering facts actually revealed in the book they do not understand and probably do not accept. The revealed facts and truth of the eternal living God. And that passage was Romans chapter 8 and then verse 19. It says, for the earnest expectation of the creature waits for the manifestation of the sons of God. For the creature or for the universe was made subject to vanity or futility. Not willingly, but by reason of him who subjected the same in hope. For the creature, for the universe, for all creation itself also shall be delivered from bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the sons of God. For we know that the whole creation, the whole universe, groans in travail and pain until now. It's all in decay and futility. And not only they, but we ourselves, which also have the first fruits of the Spirit, we ourselves groan in ourselves, waiting for the adoption, or as it should read, sonship. The translators just couldn't believe the implications of sonship, so they changed it. Sonship, to wit, the redemption of our body. That's what these planets showed, a universe in bondage to decay. Exactly what the Bible talks about. Oh, and I do have the Revised Standard Version, which is just over the page. I should have read from there. So Mr. Armstrong talked about how thrilled he was watching those pictures, seeing, confirming exactly what the Bible says. Confirming the state the Bible reveals such planets are in today. And then in that co-worker letter, Mr. Armstrong went on to write, this is all part of the wonderful, true gospel, the good news of the coming kingdom of God, soon now to come, the gospel the world has not heard from the first century AD until now, the most important work on the face of the earth today, revealing the glorious good news of the future glory of man in his salvation and what we shall accomplish throughout the entire universe. So Mr. Armstrong was looking at those Mars pictures and tying them right in with the gospel and the message that hasn't been preached but was now being preached around the world. Those Mars pictures, because you read this chapter here and it says, well, those places out in the universe, they're in bondage to decay. The whole creation is in bondage to decay, subject to futility. But it's not always going to remain that way. It's waiting. It's waiting for God's plan. It's waiting for God's first fruit. It's waiting for the glorious liberty of the children of God. Not adopted children either. Born children of God. And the universe is waiting for that because God's family will be going out into the universe and beautifying it. Mr. Armstrong wrote, "Co-workers and brethren, this is the most glorious mission ever confirmed on any creature." So man won't find answers in this Mars mission. He won't find out where we came from or a way to solve man's problems by leaving the Earth and terraforming a new world. But if we believe the Bible, there's still a massive hope there. And we talked in the first half about God's throne bringing light to this earth, God training people to bring light to this earth. But that vision isn't confined to the earth. It's not just life and light and beauty and peace on this earth. God says that he's going to do that throughout, bring that to the whole universe. This throne of David that we talk about at the start will bring light and life to that whole universe. And if you want to learn more about this, please do read that book, The Incredible Human Potential by Mr. Armstrong, which will just prove to you comprehensively from the Bible the future that God has in store, the amazing, the almost unbelievable future, the future so great that it's just hard to get your mind around. So again, we'd be very happy to send you that. You can get that at our website, thetrumpet.com. If you can request it via email. You can send us any comments via email. You can get in touch at td@kpcg.fm. That's about it from me. Please do join us again tomorrow when I believe Mr. Flurry will be back here on 101.3 on the FM dial or at kpcg.fm.